This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Is immigration good for the U.S. economy? A new book published by the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research examines that issue from the perspective of several economists. Western Michigan University economics professor Susan Pozo edited the book, The Human and Economic Implications of 21st Century Immigration Policy. She is also director of Global and International Studies at WMU. Susan Pozo, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
How did this book come about?
Well, there was a lot of talk about immigration policy that was going around at about the time that the Department of Economics was looking for individuals to possibly run a series. And this is my area of expertise. It's my area of research currently. I've been looking at immigration policy. And I said, well, the time is ripe to invite prominent economists to campus to talk to us about this and to help us sort through all of the complicated issues that surround immigration policy.
And so this is sort of a compilation of what these economists said as they came to Western for a speaker series. What's the time frame?
So they came for the 2016-17 year, and for the Warner Sichel economics lecture series, they came at different points during the academic year. They gave a public lecture attended by interested persons, students. I ran a little course along with it that students were expected to attend and do a bit of research. But also there was great interest from the public in town also on this policy because it had been in the news 24/7 for quite a bit.
And you tell us in chapter one that this was not the first time something like this had been done at Western. It also happened in the 1980s.
That's correct. And I was a young assistant professor then, and I came to town, and I was very interested in immigration policy, although it was not really the focus of my research at that point in time. But I said, oh, well, this will be fun to run a series because we were talking about what eventually became known as the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, and there were debates going on in Congress and across the country concerning the issue of undocumented immigration. And so at that point, I invited six scholars, again, throughout the year to come and provide lectures on immigration policy. These, the scholars that ended up coming, ended up being really, most of them were relatively young at the time. They were starting out, and they ended up becoming really the premier scholars in the field of immigration in the years to come. So it was a nice group. I look back fondly on them.
And one of the things you tell us in this opening chapter is that the tone of the debate in the 1980s was quite different from the tone of the debate now. How so?
Night and day. It was very, very different. Then there was real economic discourse, I think. Individuals were going about using economic modeling to really assess the implications of a policy that would be implemented, or if not implemented, what would happen. And it was serious economic research that was being played out in the field and in the to the public. And today there is, of course, a lot of serious economic and policy research that is taking place, but it just doesn't get the play that it got back then.
So chapter two is the economic and fiscal effects of immigration implications for policy. This examines some of the trends in illegal and legal immigration as well. Let's talk about that first of all, the breakdown. There's a belief that many of the people here, the overwhelming majority, are here illegally. What's the actual numbers on that?
Yeah, well, actually, what we happen to know is at this point in time, the number of undocumented immigrants has declined. It's been declining over the past 5 or 6 years. You know, that may have to do partly, it started with the recession that we had and followed through with some of the, more restrictive immigration policies that were being implemented, the discourse that was going on with respect to undocumented immigration. Also, there are a lot, many of the undocumented immigrants were of Mexican origin. But what happened is that Mexico has ended up prospering. And that also, there was a demographic change in birth rates in Mexico and so forth. And all of those factors ended up actually reducing the push of poor individuals from Mexico to the United States. So currently today, net migration, yes, net immigration from Mexico is negative.
Is part of that, that there's greater security and a greater effort to enforce immigration laws and maybe more deportation?
There certainly is more deportation. You know, depending on who is deported, you may have incentives to remigrate. Individuals who are deported and their children are left in the United States have great incentives to return to the United States, however they can, because the pull of your child being here alone, without people to support them, will overwhelm individuals. The reasons that deportation that net migration has fallen, there is the case that there's also less short-term migration, circular migration that took place as a result of the increased border enforcement, and that reduction in circular migration, caused some people, yes, to basically decide not to come anymore, to stay in Mexico, and others to stay in the United States and not return home.
Become more entrenched here.
Become more entrenched. Become permanent immigrants as a result of those. Those increased barriers to mobility. We've had in the United States over time a lot of, for example, agricultural workers that was started at the time of the Second World War when we needed individuals to pick the crops, and the Bracero program, and that. Now, people got used to just coming and going 6 months here in the United States, 6 months back in Mexico or wherever. But as a result of the change in immigration policy, which cut the Bracero program and then caused individuals who had been legal immigrants year after year after year into undocumented immigrants, also ended up changing the whole scene for this type of migration.
I found that interesting because one of the things you will hear from people who want stricter immigration policy, they'll say, hey, I'm fine with immigrants coming. They need to come legally. And there has been an increase in the temporary visas, which employers have sought. That's part of what we read in Chapter 2 of this book, which is links perhaps to not as many illegal immigrants being available to hire. So you could look at the system in that narrow sense and say it seems to be working. But you're pointing out some of the other things that go on when you increase enforcement and when you deport more people. It does get messy, doesn't it?
It really does. It does. The cost that children have had as a result of this policy is quite remarkable.
Chapter 3, socioeconomic integration of U.S. immigrant groups over the long term, the second generation and beyond. This is an examination of how the first generation may experience coming to the United States, but then how the subsequent generations experience it. How different are those experiences?
Well, this is really interesting in this area of research, looking at how what economists and others are always interested in is to the degree to which immigrants assimilate. And by assimilation, we define it in a lot of different ways, but one way would be, at what point do they end up blending in terms of, for example, their employment, their educational level, their fertility rate, and so forth. And we have had trouble examining that because we don't identify the second and third generations very easily. The data, the census data, and so forth make it difficult to identify those individuals. And so we can't, it's been hard to compare. And so Trejo and others in this chapter have looked at how it is that we can kind of go back and figure out whether what happens to the second generation. And what they find is when they can identify these individuals quite well and accurately in standard data, that that they do assimilate, that they do start appearing to be more like individuals who are in the United States. But what happens is that in the general public, there is this notion today, and you hear people saying it time after time, oh, the immigrants of today, they don't assimilate, not like the immigrants of yesterday, but the immigrants of today don't assimilate. And what one of the things that Trejo points out is that, well, what you actually have is you have selective ethnic attrition. And what we mean by selective ethnic attrition is that the individuals who are most successful are individuals who somehow they drop their ethnic identity. And then we don't recognize that they're immigrants. So, I mean, I'm a case in point. I mean, people look at me all the time and they say, oh, well, you know, you're not Hispanic, you're not Latina. And I said, but yes, I am. I am the child of Latin American immigrants. And, but I'm successful, I have a PhD, and so people forget about me when talking about the issue of assimilation. And they only look at individuals who they visibly identify as immigrants or children of immigrants, and then say, well, immigrants and their children don't assimilate.
And dropping the identity happens on the side of the person who is viewing the immigrant or the person of descent from another country. In other words, how the public sort of views maybe the CEO of a company who came from another land.
I think that it happens both ways. I think it happens in both directions. I think that there's a history, and I know a lot of people like this whose parents said, "No, drop your accent. Don't ever say that you are that you're the child of immigrants, because then you're not going to be as successful. You're not going to make it. There are going to be barriers in the way. I don't want you to have an accent.
Maybe change your name.
And maybe change your name. And, on the other hand, there are other individuals who, for example, my own kids in school, I got calls all the time saying, your child ended up filling out this form incorrectly because she said she's Hispanic. And I said, well, we are Hispanic. And it was sort of like, oh, so it happens, I think, both ways.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. I'm speaking with Western Michigan University economics professor Susan Pozo. She is the editor of a new book published by the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. It's called The Human and Economic Implications of 21st Century Immigration Policy. One of the things Chapter 3 gets into a little bit is who is actually competing for jobs, because we will hear immigrants are coming here, and then there's a competition for jobs with people who were born in the United States. How much does that actually happen, do we think?
That's a very important economic issue that economists have looked at for years and years and years. To what extent do immigrants substitute for native workers? To what extent do they compete for their jobs? To what extent do they compromise the earnings powers of native workers? And it's a difficult issue to analyze, and economists have spent a lot of time and a lot of sweat doing so. And for the most part, what they've come to find is that there's actually relatively little substitutability, that immigrants take jobs that are, if they're going to compete with anyone, who they tend to compete with are prior immigrants, and not so much the native born. They compete with the earlier waves of immigrants who may have been in the job a little longer, who might not be able to be moving on to other types of jobs for one reason or the other, maybe because they're undocumented. So that's where the competition the substitution seems to be, and not so much. Also, immigrants just tend to move. When they don't find jobs in one place, they move. They're very mobile. They don't have roots. Whereas, you know, maybe I have roots here because my kids are here. You know, immigrants are a little freer in that regard and are likely to move on to areas where their labor is needed.
Chapter 4, Immigrants in Poverty. How do they cope with it and how do they affect natives? One of the interesting things that comes up in this chapter is how being towards the bottom of the income ladder is a different experience depending on if you've been born in the United States or if you came here as an immigrant. How do those two things play out?
If you're born here, you have ability to, for example, participate in social programs that might be available to you. And if you're not, you do not have that ability to do so. And the safety net doesn't exist for you in that regard. So there certainly is a great advantage to being born here. But even that, at this point, if you're born here to an immigrant, the recent laws that are being implemented or that are being discussed to be implemented may even limit the ability of U.S.-born children to avail of those resources because immigrants who are here, even I'm talking about legal immigrants, yeah, who are here, they will be charged with being a public charge if their child uses resources.
Benefits are different if you are an immigrant, even a legal immigrant.
Benefits are legal immigrants are in many cases are restricted from using from availing of the safety net, and at least for a certain number of years until they become citizens, and yes, so there yeah so if there there's a gradation of access to those services.
What about illegal immigrants? If someone is here undocumented, are there things that they can take advantage of?
There's very, very little that they can take advantage of. Maybe one exception would be DACA recipients, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which are, depending in different areas, might be able to avail of certain services.
What about taxes? Do people who are here undocumented still pay taxes?
Yes, they do. That's one thing that people really don't recognize, that individuals, there are ways that firms are able to, individuals get what is referred to as an I-10 that they fill out. It has a unique number, and their payroll taxes are taken out of their wages. And so, yes, and undocumented immigrants are actually very eager to have that take place because there is some thought that maybe in the future, if they can become legal immigrants, that having paid their taxes will be helpful in that in petitioning for legal status. So yes, undocumented immigrants pay taxes. And they usually do not get refunds. They don't get refunds, and so they're really putting in more than they take out in that regard.
Chapter 5 is Understanding the Consequences of Heightened Interior Immigration Enforcement. Is this an attempt to try to do what may be very difficult in this day and age, a dispassionate cost-benefit analysis of what it means to more actively try to enforce immigration laws?
What's happened with immigration laws, with immigration enforcement, is that it has moved from simply being the border enforcement to being interior enforcement. And so what the authors in that chapter are doing is looking at some of the impacts of that heightened immigration enforcement on a number of variables, and a lot of the variables that they work on are children, the impacts on children, the impacts of child separation on children, on their poverty status, and these we may be talking about children who are born in the United States who are U.S. citizen children. the number of children who are going into foster care as a result of that heightened immigration enforcement, which is, of course, all messed up with the whole issue of to what extent does, you know, can the federal government mandate that local authorities enforce immigration? And there is, of course, there's differences in the enforcement that takes place, and they take advantage of that variation across local areas to see what the impact is of heightened immigration enforcement.
Chapter 6 looks at the parallels between immigration and trade policy. Is it not coincidental that immigration and trade seem to have risen to the top of our radar politically within the last few years?
Yeah, well, we're talking about globalization. We're talking about information flows. We're talking about trade flows, financial flows. I mean, they all go together. It's very interesting, of course, that when we talk about international trade, my other area of expertise, that we have the same issues. We have costs and benefits, and sometimes what we mostly find is that if we can compensate the losers with the gains from the gainers, everyone's better off, that we have a more efficient economy. And those same tools and those same arguments and those same theories can be applied, many economists believe, to immigration.
Chapter 7 deals with policies related to asylum. How much can we look at asylum and try to put it in economic terms, and how much does it remain a humanitarian consideration primarily?
Well, in terms of policy, I think that one needs to distinguish refugees from asylees. It's something that most people don't recognize, but refugees are individuals who are in a country outside of their own country. They're in a third country. They petition to come to the United States or anywhere as a refugee because they cannot go home. And asylees are similar in some respects, but very different, because asylees come into the country and then petition, or come to the border of the country and then petition for asylum. And yes, it is a humanitarian issue, and one that is very real today and in history. You know, we can go back and think of the errors that we made in history with respect to not providing refuge or asylum for individuals who were in dire need of protections.
Can you also take a look at where people came to this country and were able to do pretty amazing things? Who did get in under these circumstances? You know, when policies changed, et cetera. I mean, is that, I suppose, another, if you want to look at it and create a positive story that you would then, you know, translate into policy in this day and age, can you find those examples of people who did come to this country and did thrive after they got in as a refugee or seeking asylum?
I think that we do know that the Jewish refugee flows that came in, you know, on account of World War II, that they made amazing
contributions
to our economy throughout.
Are there things which are difficult to really study as an economist about immigration? Because in some cases we're talking about, as you say, people who are undocumented. You know, is getting data on those sort of things sometimes difficult?
Oh, we're very resourceful. Economists are very resourceful, and we have ways of getting that information. It's not perfect, and we continue to work on it. But we have made tremendous progress on that, and we do happen to actually know a lot about undocumented immigrants. We do happen to know we are able to get information. We are able to produce high quality work in that area. We have our ways, you know, just like any type of undocumented migration, illegal flows of other sorts, illegal activity in general, leave traces in the economy, and we're able to pick up on those traces. And there are other ways that we can that we are able to sift through the data and get information.
You tell us in the chapter you wrote that it's important to look at research and be careful about basing policy based on anecdotal evidence. At the same time, is it possible that immigration is a net positive and maybe a substantial net positive for the United States economy, and yet we could find some individual stories where someone is worse off economically because of immigration.
There's no doubt about that. It's just like any when we have progress in any way, if we look at history and you look at the, you know, jobs that were destroyed as a result of technological innovation, does make some individuals worse off. And the question is, okay, well, shall we, you know, let's outlaw electricity and let's continue to work with candles. Of course, there are people who are going to be worse off. And we as a country, what we need to do is we need to band together, we need to get together, and we need to help redistribute the gains that go to the winners to the losers. But there seems to be, in some respects, you know, reluctance to do that in this country. You know, say, okay, we're all going to raise ourselves through our own bootstraps. But there is a tremendous capacity. There's a tremendous gain from, I think, immigration and international trade that can be collected and dispersed so that everyone is better off and we have a more efficient economy, we have a more smoothly operating institutions.
I'd like to read the dedication at the beginning of this book. I would like to dedicate this volume to immigrants in honor of your many achievements and in sympathy for the sacrifices that come from leaving your home to offer your talents in a new country. Can you expound on that a little bit?
I think that it's difficult to migrate. It's difficult to leave the familiar, to go to the unknown. You do it because you want to make a better life for your children. You do it because you may have to leave people behind who you know are going to be harmed because they can't come with you. I think there are tremendous sacrifices that you come going to a place that is going to the unknown, and I admire that. I've known a lot of people who have made many sacrifices, and I really do admire they've made sacrifices that have made my life the wonderful life that I have today.
Susan Pozo is the editor of The Human and Economic Implications of 21st Century Immigration Policy. She's also a professor of economics and director of global and international studies at Western Michigan University. Susan Pozo, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The book, The Human and Economic Implications of 21st Century Immigration Policy, is published by the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. Links with more details can be found at WMUK.org. WMUK's West Southwest is available at WMUK.org and through the WMUK app. At Apple iTunes and Google Play, you can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast. There you can also leave a rating and write a review. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.